The order of Melchizedek simply means an eternal order. No beginning, no ending. The priests of Aaron, they die. All the priests of the Old Testament leading up to Jesus lived and died. And now you have Jesus, who is eternal in the order of Melchizedek.
Why is the eternality of Christ's high priesthood so important for us? That's the question John Piper answers from Hebrews 5, 4 to 10 in this episode of Light and Truth. This sermon was originally preached at Bethlehem Baptist Church on September 22nd, 1996.
Christ has eternity in the order of Melchizedek, verse 7, just as he says also in another passage, namely Psalm 110, verse 4, thou art a priest forever, key word, forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. Melchizedek. Now in chapter 7 of Hebrews, Melchizedek comes in for extensive treatment. So I'm going to save details for chapter 7 and give you a little 2-minute summary of Melchizedek here and who in the world this fellow is and why he becomes so important. This is amazing. This is amazing. You know how many times Melchizedek is referred to in the Old Testament? Twice. Genesis 14:18, Abraham is coming back from the defeat of the kings. He's near Sodom, and here comes out of nowhere Melchizedek, king of righteousness, Melchizedek, king of righteousness. And he blesses Abraham, and Abraham pays him tithes, and the text says simply, he was priest of God Most High. And he's gone. For 1,000 years, you don't hear from him again or about him. And then, one more time, in the whole Old Testament, boom, there he is again. Psalm 110, verse 4, and never again. And what you see in Psalm 110, verse 4, is David quoting God, saying about the Messiah, he is a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. Now, the next time you hear of him is the book of Hebrews. Boom, right here. And that's it. Nobody else in the New Testament refers to him, and nowhere else in the Old Testament. That's amazing. And what it shows is that this writer of the book of Hebrews is a lover and a believer in the detailed inspiration of the Old Testament. Because he looks at that and he says, Melchizedek, coming out of nowhere, blessing Abraham, receiving tithes, poof, he vanishes out. And then David saying that the Messiah will be a priest, not according to the Aaronic or the Levitical line, but the Melchizedek order. What is that? The order of Melchizedek. He just was there for a verse and he's gone. And he thinks and he ponders, and this is what he concludes. Melchizedek is symbolically a pointer toward a priesthood that will be outside Aaron and outside Levi and outside the law, of a wholly different nature. And then he ponders, well, what kind of pointers might there be? Well, he just appears. And we don't know who his parents were, and we don't know who his lineage was, and poof, he's gone. We don't know where he went. And so it appears like there was no beginning and there's no ending. And that's exactly what he says in chapter 7, verse 3. Christ realizes what Melchizedek symbolizes. Namely, he is without beginning and without ending. And he gathers all of that up out of what David did under the inspiration of God with this image or this person back here in Genesis 14. So the point here, let's just take one piece of it, and we'll do more in chapter 7. The point here is, the order of Melchizedek simply means an eternal order. No beginning, no ending. The priests of Aaron, they died. All the priests of the Old Testament leading up to Jesus lived and died. And now you have Jesus, who is eternal in the order of Melchizedek. Why does this matter? I'll put it this way. Do you want to be an oak tree saint or a cattail saint? I have very clear images in my mind of a particular oak tree and a particular group of cattails. When I taught at Bethel, I would drive across E2 for 6 years, take a right onto Old Snelling, and there on the left is this marsh, and there's these cattails. I remember them because the blackbirds would sit on top of them. These red-winged blackbirds like to sit on points of things. And they would kind of sway and wobble with the bird. And when the winds were blowing and the rains were coming, these were whipping back and forth. And they died every year and underneath that mess. And I wondered how many generations of cattails are lying there. Thousands of years of cattails mucky under that stuff at Lake Valentine. And I thought, that's not the way I want to be. I don't want to be a cattail saint. Falling over in the wind and sinking down in the muck every year, disappearing, having to be replaced. But in Georgia, where I work, and I've written about this, where I sit in a little study outside my mother-in-law's house, there's an oak tree. We're talking serious oak tree here. I walked up to this oak tree and put my arms around it like this, and I think maybe I'm a third of my span is 6 feet from tip to tip here. I put my arm around it and do it again. I figure it must be 15, 18 feet around. And about maybe 8 feet up comes the first limb straight out. The limb is probably this big around. It takes 200 years to get a limb like that, not counting the tree. And it goes horizontal, flat with the earth, I don't know, 40, 50 feet straight out like that. And there's a swing hanging under it about 10 feet out. And I've often sat with Noel on that swing and thinking, if this limb breaks, we are jelly. I want to be an oak tree. I just think of the winds that have beat on that thing for centuries. Beat it and beat it and beat it, and it just, it's like rock. The little cattail goes, beep. Now, tell me what psalm in the Bible tells us how to become an oak tree. Which psalm is it? 1. That's right. It says, his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. He will be like a tree. Not a cattail, a tree. So if you want to become an oak tree saint, you meditate on the law of the Lord, which is what this is. This is the writer to the Hebrews doing some of it for you and then offering it to you to do for yourself. He's meditating on Melchizedek, and he's meditating on the Messiah and the priestly order, and he's meditating on the sonship, and he's meditating on the dignity and eternity of Jesus and how it relates to him becoming the source of eternal salvation, and he becomes strong. Don't be a cattail saint. Be an oak tree saint by meditating on the Word of God. Which brings us finally to the last one, purity. He becomes the source of eternal salvation because he has the purity of fiery testing. Now, some people ask this. I asked it. Does the dignity and the eternity of the Son of God mean that his purity was automatic? Well, of course he's going to be pure. He's Son of God. Eternal Son of God, pure. Automatic. Now this text is written to say a loud no to that. Look at verse 8 first of all. Although he was a son, and you see in the word although, that he's saying something unexpected here. You would think that the son wouldn't have to learn obedience through suffering. And he says, oh no, although he was a son, he learned obedience from the things which he suffered. Now that does not mean he started as disobedient and he became obedient. It means he started as untested and he became proven. All eternity, the Son has obeyed the Father perfectly. Every will that the Father has, the Son has. Every inclination, every desire that the Father has, the Son just resonates perfectly with it because they are one in a profound way. But never until the incarnation did the Son suffer one millisecond. And when he clothes himself with humanity, it's for one main reason, that he might hurt and die. When it says he learned obedience, it means he learned what it was like to obey through pain, through temptation, through suffering. And the question is, was that automatic? Look at verse 7. It says he prayed and he begged and he cried out and he wept with tears. This was no fake test. All the universe hung on this test. And you ask, I ask, was it brief? Was the testing and the suffering and the crucible, the white hot pain brief? And the reason I ask that is because many interpreters take this verse 7 as a reference only to Gethsemane. Here he is, remember, in Gethsemane. He's sweating drops of blood. He's saying, oh God, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me. And they say, that's what we're hearing in verse 7. That's not quite right. And the reason it's not quite right is found in the word days. You see that plural word? In the days. Not night or day, but days. In the days of his flesh. That means while he was incarnate, he wept and he cried and he prayed and he agonized. Jesus' whole life was one of wrestling with God. Now you ask, I ask, for what? When it says in verse 7 at the end that he's praying to the one who is able to save him from death, does that mean what he's crying for is to escape physical death? And that in the days of his flesh, all his daily life, he was praying not to die. Is that what that means? I find that really hard to believe. Because the Bible pictures Jesus with his face set like flint. The Son of Man must go up to Jerusalem and there be rejected by the chief priests and the scribes and be spit upon and beaten. And they will crucify him, and on the third day he will rise. He had set his face like flint to die. For this reason the Son of Man came into the world, that he might give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus was not constantly saying, oh God, don't let me do what you sent me to do. Rather, Jesus knew there was a death worse than death. Namely, sin. There would have been something infinitely worse than dying on the cross, and that is for the Son of God to sin, to be impure, to have one impure, lustful thought toward Mary Magdalene would end our salvation. That was what was at stake. That's what caused crying and agonizing and praying and tears and sweating. Oh my God, yes, my flesh does not like the thought of nails piercing and swords, or thorns, but God, I fear sin. I fear not enduring to the end. I fear not being able to lay myself down as a pure and holy sacrifice. Spare me, save me. All the days of his life he prayed that, I believe. From the time Satan was tempting in the wilderness till he went away and prayed all night, day by day by day, the Son of Man was saying, this day, Lord, Almighty God, my Father, prevent me from making shipwreck of salvation by sinning and being an impure sheep. And God answered him. This is one of my reasons for thinking this. Do you see that in verse 7? He was heard. I don't think that means God picked up on the wave. Oh, I hear a voice. I hear a voice. That's not what that means. That means he answered him. He answered him. Which means his prayer succeeded. Because his prayer was, oh God, don't let me be impure. Don't let me sin. Don't let me ruin the cross. Don't let me ruin the plan of redemption. Save me. Keep me. Hold me. Don't let me sin. And day by day, just like with you and me, we need to fight it. And Jesus Christ, bless him. Oh, we should love him. He fought this thing every day and he won every day and he fought it right into the worst battle of Gethsemane. Yes, I hear Gethsemane here. Yes, I hear the blood dripping. And yes, I hear the normal human flesh rising and saying, oh God, if there were another way besides the cross, I hate the thought of the cross. I've seen them die on the cross. Sure, he said that. But beneath that, there was another prayer. And it was more important than that prayer. And it was, oh God, when I stand before those people tomorrow, let me say, Father, forgive them. Because if I get angry and if I give vent to sinful rage, there will be no salvation. And all your plan will abort. That's what he bought. Meditate, brothers and sisters, on the purity of Jesus. Meditate on his dignity, his eternity, and his purity. Because of those three things, he has become for you the source of eternal salvation. Now let me close with this question. Are you saved? Verse 9 will tell you if you are. You see that? Having been made perfect, he became to all those who obey him the source of eternal salvation. So, I'll ask the question a different way. Not are you saved, but are you obeying Jesus? Or are you living in disobedience from him? If you are living in disobedience, you do not have warrant to believe that you have salvation. Now, obedience in the book of Hebrews is first and foremost obedience to the command to trust the promises of God. It is very interesting that in the first, I believe it is, 9 chapters of this book, there's not one practical ethical command. But there are many commands to believe, to hope, to trust, to hold fast your confession, to draw near to God, to rest in his promises. So the first thing we must hear when it says obey is, will you obey this morning the command, trust me? Have I not enough dignity? Have I not enough eternity? Have I not enough purity that when I lay down my life that you might have forgiveness and acceptance forever, you can trust me? That's the command to be obeyed first. Every other kind of obedience flows from that obedience. And so the bottom line question as we leave is, are you willing this morning, right now, to look at the promises of sin? You got them in your mind? Got some sins planned for this week? The only reason anybody is sinning is because sin makes promises. Look at the promises of sin and say to them, you are a liar. And then look at the promises of God and say, you are true. And embrace these. Believe them, trust them, bank on them. Hold fast to them, as Hebrews says. And you will know that you have eternal salvation.
This is Light and Truth, God-centered preaching to help you see Christ clearly and treasure Him truly. I'm your host, Dan Kruver. Thank you for listening. On our next episode, John Piper continues our series, Consider Jesus, with a sermon titled, The Nourishing Word. I hope you'll join us. For more resources, visit desiringgod.org.